Good morning, and welcome to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. When South Sudan gained independence from Sudan on July 9th of 2011, it was the outcome of a peace deal that ended Africa's longest-running civil war. Today on the show, getting to know the Sudanese refugees who have come to call Kansas City home. We bring you the story of a former Sudanese lost boy who now has a boy of his own, looking for a connection to his father's homeland, a place he had never known until just recently. We're also looking at the ways local Sudanese are working to stay connected to their families and homeland, helping to rebuild the new nation from afar. Later in the hour, a look at the Midwest Music Foundation, a group that helps area musicians get access to healthcare and make a mark on one of the largest music festivals of its kind in the world. Stay with us for Central Standard just after this hour's news. Welcome to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Good morning. The civil war in Sudan, fueled by conflict between the Arab Muslim North and the Christian animist South, tore the nation apart, a civil war lasting decades. Sudan's second civil war from 1983 to 2005 left more than 2 million dead and drove 4.5 million civilians from their home. And now, even after South Sudan has gained its independence in July of 2011, making it the newest country in the world, displacement and conflict continues for some. From 2003 to the present, the war in Darfur, Sudan, has killed hundreds of thousands and driven 2.5 million people from their home. With assistance from groups like Catholic Charities, Don Bosco, and Jewish Vocational Services in Kansas City has become a home to a large population of Sudanese refugees. Today on the show, getting to know some of these Sudanese here in Kansas City and the many ways they have stayed connected to their homeland, which is now recognized as a sovereign nation, but is still plagued by poverty and conflict on its path to rebuilding. We're joined by Martin Opereki from Jewish Vocational Services, a community outreach and volunteer coordinator. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And soon we'll be joined by Rebecca Mabior and John Akui and their son, Atem. And some of you may remember hearing about Atem and John on KC Currents earlier in December. KCUR's Alex Smith did a story on them, and we're going to start by hearing a segment of that story now.
Growing up in southern Sudan, John and his family struggled with poverty and lack of opportunity, but these trials couldn't prepare him for what came next. In 1983, when John was 4 years old, the Sudanese government started attacking southern towns to stop the emergence of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, which was started to stand up for the people of southern Sudan. The Sudanese military targeted young boys to prevent them from joining the SPLA. In 1987, on the night the army came to John's village, he and the other boys ran to escape being killed. They ran all night and hid out during the day for the next 30 days, eventually traveling 1,000 miles through the brush to refuge in Ethiopia. John Akui still has scars around his ankles from running during this month-long exodus.
Those scratches happened when I hit the wood with my leg when I was running, and I feel the pain. But, you know, because of fear, I wasn't really focusing on pain. I was focusing on how to get away.
John eventually settled in a refugee camp in Kenya, where he lived for 9 years. In 2001, John and about 3,800 other lost boys of Sudan were allowed to resettle in the United States. John took a job at a paper company in Kansas City and joined a growing community of Sudanese expatriates here. And at a Sudanese community get-together, he met Rebecca Mabior.
The first time I saw her, it was so amazing. And I was just say, oh, you know, I'm lucky. I saw a girl here that came from Sudan and, you know, she looked like us. And I would maybe see if we can, you know, get together sometime.
Rebecca, like John, is slender and well over 6 feet tall. Though she grew up in the north of Sudan, Rebecca is also Dinka. John says it's important to the lost boys to find Sudanese wives and start Sudanese families.
We feel like if we marry from our own community, then we will keep the same story together, and then we will think about the people back home together. So this will keep us strong, and we are not going to lose our history, so we will keep our history to the generation to come.
Rebecca and John were married in 2003, and Atem was born a year after that. They later had twins, a boy and a girl named Akui and Akon. Although the couple was committed to helping Sudan, they hadn't discussed it with their children. John says he was surprised when Atem first suggested collecting pencils.
First of all, my reaction, I wasn't prepared enough even to tell people about my hometown. So my son took over and tell me what I supposed to do. So I feel guilty. You know, when Atem was starting that, I was really feel guilty. Even the water started to drop in my eyes because I say, Atem, how did Atem just saw something in the internet and begin to ask me and my wife that we could deliver only 10 pencils? And we are the one who bought that 10 pencils. I didn't even thought about giving 10 pencils to children in South Sudan. So I feel guilty at that time, and I don't want to let it go, because it was a chance for me. You know, he was just reminding me on what we're supposed to do.
Atem and his parents started talking to friends, classmates, co-workers, and church congregants about Sudan and asked their help with collecting pencils and other school supplies. The drive was more successful than any of them could have imagined. They've collected nearly 38,000 pencils and other school supplies as well. And now that Atem has been asking about Sudan, John and Rebecca have been more open to talking about it, though they're still reluctant to tell him the details of the war.
Well, the thing that I want Atem, you know, to know, Atem, at least, he want to know where I came from. That will let him understand, you know, why am I here. So I tell Atem that, Atem, we are belong to South Sudan. I came from far away, and we came here because somebody, you know, the government didn't like us because of our differences, our religious. And I did not talk much about what was the big impact, what is really affecting us. But I was just, because Atem is still 8 years old, he need to know some of my background, but he don't need to know everything because his mind is still devolving.
The Second Sudanese Civil War ended in 2005, and in July of 2012, South Sudan became an independent country. John and Rebecca decided they wanted Atem to see the new country, so on Christmas Day, Atem and his mother will go there to see relatives and deliver some pencils. John explains why it's important for Atem to see South Sudan.
Atem need to go there and see with his own eyes. And then I want Atem to go and sit under the tree with them also and see how it feel like to sit under the tree and ride in the dirt. I want Atem also to know that these are, you know, his brothers and sisters who are suffering there. Not only people that he's helping them. It's his blood. And he want to feel it also. By sitting down there, how do you feel like? And when he come back here, I think Atem will always be focusing, you know, on how we can help those people back home. And also, I need also those people who are back home to feel like we are not forgetting about them. We never forget about them. We are still with them, and we will be always with them.
That story was from KCUR's Alex Smith. It first aired in December. You can hear the full version on our website at kcur.org. And now we're joined in the studio by Atem, Rebecca Mabior, and John Akwe. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
Thank you for having us.
So, Atem, how old are you?
I am 8 years old.
8 years old. And so what was it like going to Sudan? You're back now. It's March. What was the trip like?
Well, when I met the children, it was kind of like a new experience to me.
What was new about it to you?
That they don't have the clothes like we have in America.
So clothes were something that you noticed. What other things just pop out at you as different? Because this was your first time being to Sudan.
It's mostly warm there than sometimes cold.
So there's a lot of big differences to consider. Rebecca and John, Rebecca, you do medical interpreting now for Samuel Rogers and work with a lot of Sudanese. Can you talk briefly about your connection to the Sudanese population here in Kansas City?
Thank you for having us. First, like when you talk about connection to South Sudanese, we always stay connected because when we left the land, we were forced out. And then we promise ourselves that we are not going to leave them alone. So ever since I came to this country, it just like always I'm thinking about it, about them, just like we gather together very often. And then when I took like this job as an interpreter, I just feel like I'm doing more. Like when they come like a first time and they're newcomers, they don't know their ways around, they don't know how the medical care is provided here. So it's a privilege for me to just explain to them and just like tell them, like, take a deep breath. You are in a good hand.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Today's topic, we're getting to know our Sudanese neighbors, Sudanese refugees who are living here in Kansas City. And John Akwe, you were with Rebecca and Atem just recently back in Sudan. What was that experience like for you coming home now that Sudan is considered a sovereign nation?
I did not went to Sudan.
It was just you, Rebecca, that went. Okay.
Yeah, it was Rebecca and Atem. They went to South Sudan.
But have you been back?
I went back in 2006, and South Sudan was not an independent country that time.
What was the scene like then there as you went back home?
Things were still difficult. We did not have a freedom that time to become South Sudan, and the government of Sudan was still under control of other things. So there was no really opportunities, and the government is controlling the power. So it was just very different during that times than now.
And Rebecca, so kind of going back to this trip that you and Atem took, I'm sorry I confused that earlier, the point of that trip was to send school supplies to South Sudan, which was Atem's idea. Can you talk about how that idea came to be, how you organized it, and then how it was received when you went to Sudan?
First of all, like when we are here, we knew we wanted to help people back there. And then those people are extended family. Some of them are our immediate family. We left brothers, mothers, children there. So all the time we knew we wanted to help. The idea was put up together. It was 2011 when Atem was six. He came to us with the idea he wanted to donate his 10 pencils to the children who don't have those pencils. So, and then after that, me and John sat together and said, okay, let's start with the pencils. We took Atem 10 pencils, and I had a post in my job. And then my supervisor, Teresa Gomez, she welcomed the idea. We put a box and we read on it like a 10 pencil box. And then very soon the pencils were piled up together very soon. And then we had about 1,000 pencils. I took those 1,000 pencils back in 2011 during the independence. So, and then when his school knew, our churches knew that, everybody start giving pencils, and then now we have 38,000 pencils. And it was my father's idea. He said, okay, since this is his idea, he need to come and just hand the pencil to the children himself. He need to inspire those children so they don't feel left alone. So, and then we took this trip. So when we went there, I'm very glad and privileged to do that. When we went there, the children, they didn't have anything. They were sitting on the trees, riding with their fingers on the dirt. And then my sisters and my parents, they collected a lot of notebooks. So they were able to write for the first time in their life. So we talked to them, we hugged them. It was just very, very new experience to me.
Atem, what was that like getting to hand over these pencils to the children that you had been organizing this thing for so long? Was it a gratifying feeling?
Yes. It felt so good. It's like you had somebody a feeling and you make them feel good when they're sad.
Yeah. Did you make a lot of friends?
Yes.
Yeah? Did you see some interesting animals that you maybe don't see here in Kansas City?
Sheep, goat, cows with some long horns.
So it's a pretty different landscape. And that's something that a lot of Sudanese refugees deal with when they get displaced and have to create a new home in a place that may be really foreign to them. And I want to bring in Martin Opereke of Jewish Vocational Services. You've worked with a lot of Sudanese refugees in helping them basically find a home here in Kansas City. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Not only with the Sudanese, we resettle refugees from all over the world. But with the Sudanese, they are very much interested in education. So I'm kind of impressed that Atem took it upon himself to help his fellow countrymen back home by collecting school supplies. So most of the Sudanese we resettle here In addition to wanting to get employed, the first thing they always do is enroll in school. And we help them with those school enrollments. And also we advise them on career choices because even though they all want to go to school, but there are certain careers that they would want to go into. But then we look at the employability of some careers and then we direct them and ultimately it's left for them to make a decision. But we connect them with schools, we assist them in completing some of the applications and also give them other support services like coming together as a group and being involved in not only their own personal life but in their community life.
How are you finding that these groups are staying together culturally? Are Sudanese sticking together a lot? And the different refugees that come over, do they kind of stick together and create a community here in Kansas City?
Yes. They stick together based on their tribe and based on their religion, but ultimately they come together as a country. Now, with Sudan, there are so many differences in terms of religion and up north, southwest, but they all love their country, regardless of their tribe, their religion, they all love their country. One of the things we found interesting is with the Sudanese Lost Boys, when they were recently resettled here in Kansas City, they were all excited and decided to not only get employed and get a job, but also to form their own local community organizations. Yes, even though they are sometimes ethnic related, but they all come together to celebrate the independence anniversary of Sudan. And just last year, I was privileged to attend the South Sudan independence anniversary celebration here in Kansas City, and it was awesome.
John Okoye, you are one of those lost boys, a term used to describe the 20,000 children, mostly boys, from the age 7 to 17 that were displaced or orphaned during the war. Can you talk a little bit about your experience in coming to America?
Yes, of course. I left my country when I was 7 years old. So I was forced by the government of Sudan to cross the desert, and I went to Ethiopia. So the number of the lost boys were between 30 to 25,000 boys during that time. And then we lost many lost boys on the way, has been attacked by wild animals. And some has been drawn in the river, and some were being attacked by the crocodiles as well. And then some has died because of disease when we reached to Ethiopia. So it was a really, it's not a good experience during that time, because we faced a lot of things that we have never faced before. Number one, we didn't have food that we carry along with us. And number two, also, we went to the desert where there's no water. And it was so difficult for us to cross to the border. I myself, I did not know that if I could make it to Ethiopia until I went to Ethiopia. So after I lived in Ethiopia for 4 years, the war broke out in Ethiopia, and then we ran back to Sudan. So and then we crossed to Kenya, and in 2001. This is when the process started to come to the USA. So for me, I was excited to come to United States of America because this is where I have the opportunity to go to school and to find a job. And we came together as a lost boy because we know each other back home. And during our struggle also. So in Kansas City here, we have a group of lost boys. Our number has reached now to 60 lost boys because we have one group in St. Joe, And we have another group in Kansas City, Kansas, and another group in Kansas City, Missouri. So,
Rebecca, what was happening to the girls being left behind in these villages during this time?
When the government was attacking the villages, it was the time when the boys were away with the cattle. And then it's a lifestyle that the girls stay in the house with the mothers. And then the boys go out running after the cattle, and then they just like walk like a mile or 2 miles away. So when this happened, particularly the girls were with the families. What happened to them is really, really sad. The government just took them, used them for so many purposes, not appropriately. So that what happened to them, that's why they're not here.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Today's topic, we're getting to know our Sudanese neighbors, talking to Sudanese refugees living here in Kansas City. If you have questions for our guests today about their experiences, or if you're a Sudanese refugee living here in Kansas City, what's your story? We'd love to hear from you. Call us at 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Later in the hour, we're going to be hearing from an organizer of the Mid-Coast Takeover, but right now we're exploring our relationship with our Sudanese neighbors. Rebecca, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your uncle, John Garang. He was a really important political leader for South Sudan.
When we talk about Dr. John Garang de Mabior, the words are not enough to describe him. He was the father and the founder of the nation. He graduated from Iowa University, having his PhD in political science, and then he went back home. So people knew he was going to have a comfortable life. Very nice house, beautiful wife, little children. But Dr. John Garang Mabior, he just decided to just liberate the whole country. And then he was here in America when the civil right was here about Martin Luther King and everything. So he was influenced by the idea of being different but still be equal. So when he went there, he recruited the educated people from South Sudan, and then he formed the SPLA, Sudanese People Liberation Army and Liberation Movement. And then after that, he just move slowly because the idea of fighting the government, it was very hard when you don't have enough educated people to do this, when you don't have an army by yourself and everything. So, and then it took him about 21 years to fight for our right, talking to the international communities and everything. 2005, after we reached the CPA, the peace agreement, John Garang was assassinated. And then part of the agreement is just to stay with the Northern for 6 years and see if we like it, and then vote for the referendum. So, and then the government of Sudan, they knew if John Garang was alive, people were going to vote for him and be the president of the whole Sudan. So he was assassinated. And then after that, when we left without hope, we didn't want to be united with the Sudanese because lack of trust, a lack of leadership to lead us through this. So the South Sudanese, they decided to go for separation, which is happened 2011. In a personal level, as an uncle, I remember Dr. John Garang when he used to come to our house from abroad. He came with a lot of toys and nice things from America. So we were always looking forward to see him. And then that was the first one we called Walen. Walen is uncle in my tribal language, because we grew up in Khartoum, the northern part of the country. So, and then we were apart from my parent family, and just we were alone there. So for somebody to come there, it was only just my uncle make it frequently to come there and make it comfortable. So we had very, very nice relationship with him as nieces and nephews. And then from that time, we haven't met till 2002 in Iowa University. And he made me as a grown woman, very tall, taller than him. So he was joking and talking to me, and he's, you know, very touching. He has a charisma that touches everybody's life. He had sense of humor. Very, very, very intelligent person.
The loss of John Garang was a major loss for all of South Sudan and a personal loss for you. But and then in 2011, when South Sudan obtained its independence, what was that feeling like for you here experiencing that so many miles away from where that was happening? What was that like for you?
Even though we are far away from home, but we never felt that way. We always connected. We know what is happening there. We are part of everything happening there. And even when they did the referendum, we were included in the process of voting. We voted here. The Center for Midwest was in Omaha, Nebraska. And then we drove, we registered, and then we drove again. We went and we voted, and we were just following anxiously to see, like, what happened. So the distance didn't take us away from home. And then every experience is very life to us. And then when the independence happened, July 9th, 2011, I went there physically. I was there in that crowd, you know. It's just, it's home. We will never be just like away from it.
Even though South Sudan has its independence, violence and human rights violations continue in Darfur, what's your sense of how Sudanese locally are staying connected to the ongoing conflict in that region with Darfur and South Sudan trying to rebuild as a nation? And I'd like to hear from everyone about this.
We don't like it necessarily because, especially like after I came here and I see like what we deserve, is eye-opening, and it make it even harder when I know like women should not be treated like that, when I know being black is not a crime, when I know it's just I can be Christian or Muslim or atheist and still a citizen. When I came here and I just see this and I see like the right way we should be treated, it make me even more angry.
Martin, do you have feelings about that?
Well, for me, I am mostly inspired by the positive attitude that people that saw oppression, repression, only to come and see all the opportunities available here, not just taking advantage of those opportunities for themselves, but also thinking about their families back home. And so with the Sudanese, I have several friends that have all gone back. As soon as the South Sudan was formed, one of my very good friends that used to work for a Catholic charity had to relocate back. And now he's part of the government. And yes, he's trying to instill some level of accountability, transparency that he saw here in the United States back home. And the last time I spoke with him at the Independence Party, he expressed some of the challenges he faced, trying to convince his contemporaries about the need for transparency, about the need for accountability, about the need to take on projects and programs that have verifiable outcome and have the most positive impact on the lives of his people. Yes, they come here, but their heart is still in South Sudan.
That's Martin Opariki, Community Outreach and Volunteer Coordinator for Jewish Vocational Services. We're talking to Rebecca Mabior, John Akwe, and their son Atem as well here in the studio about living in Kansas City as a Sudanese refugee. I would like to know a little bit more about the Sudanese community in Kansas City specifically. And Rebecca, you work as a medical interpreter for Samuel Rogers. And you were saying that a lot of the Sudanese within our community have a hard time parenting, that's kind of the most common concern that you hear, like adjusting that people have. Can you talk a little bit about what the struggle is there?
Parenting for us here is very hard, especially like our kids are getting influence from school or from outside, how they should live. And then when they're 18, they take more accountability, which we don't like as parents. We don't want our kids to take the lead when they're still in our houses. It's in Sudanese culture, when you are in your parents' house, you have to do what they want you to do. Even if you work, you just give them the money, they manage your finance and everything. Our kids who go to American school, it's different values. It's not like wrong or right, but it's just different values, and they feel like they're more independent when they do this. They're more just like reliable if they do this and that. So this is one of the problems. Another thing about the choices, their choices in their life, you know, is different. It's not like what we used to see when we were growing up. So the parents are taking it very hard, because when you raise up your kids and you want them to be like you, and they're turning to be just something different, it's heartbreaking. And for the children, they see like the parents are very controlling, and they feel in certain levels the parents don't love them. And it's typical in Sudanese families. You see like a huge family, like 6 or 7 or 10 kids. And sometimes the parents are not there in every football practice. They're not there in everything. So the kids, they feel like they're left out. And when this added to them, it makes them feel for sure that their parents, they don't love them.
There's a lot of different ethnic, religious, and diversity within Sudan. And Rebecca and John, you're both Dinka. What Dinka traditions or values have you been trying to pass on to Atem at the home in America?
Well, just like how you speak to your elderly, you call everybody uncle regardless. You shake people's hand when you see them with your right hand. So just simple things, you know, the way you speak and the way you say things. We fail in certain points to feed him Sudanese food.
Atem, do you like Sudanese food?
Depends.
It depends? What's some of your favorites?
Samosa and sharia.
Sharia.
And then some food I cook and then I put on the table and Atem is not eating.
Yeah.
So it's
we're going to go to a caller now, Jan in North Kansas City. Jan, welcome to Central Standard.
Yes, hi. Well, first of all, I have not kept up really closely here lately, but I had known about the, you know, the whole plight of Sudan, the South Sudan, and the Lost Boys, and all over the years, it's just been such a sad thing that they had to go through so much and so many hardships. And it's really a wonderful, brave thing that so many folks have, you know, come through to. You know, making new lives for themselves and all the adjustments they have to make, and worrying too about the people left back in South Sudan. I wanted to know, I know, of course, the North Sudan had been in making incursions and there'd been a lot of, problems and killing, and I wanted to know whether it was beginning to normalize now, or are there still problems with the North Sudan and, you know, and South.
John, maybe you can answer this for us.
Yeah, the problem is still existing, and it is only existing in the border between North and South Sudan. The government of Sudan is not interesting to leave the government of South Sudan alone, because they know that this is a new government, and also, they have problem of oils. So this, every time you hear there is an attack in the borders, people have been killing, and the government used to deny that, but still there are many reports if you can check it. So it is not really very safe in the border. There are army in the border, the South Sudan's army, and also the army of Sudan.
South Sudan is the world's newest country, and we mentioned before that people are starting to return back to Sudan to try to help rebuild. And with that, even people living in Kansas City and all around the world, there's a lot of civilian activism that's going on to support the rebuilding of Sudan and Darfur, kind of similar to what Atem is doing. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the projects, the other projects that you're involved in locally.
Yes. After Atem was talking about his pencils, his teacher, Linda Wanting, was his preschool teacher. And then with her church, they took a lead on this. And we formed a ministry called Journey of Hope. Journey of Hope is initially like following John's journey when he was a child chased away from home. And it's a team journey going back home to help the children. So, and then the project is put together to build school and supplies those school supplies. And then the priority this year is just to provide them clean water, because children are still drinking from the swamp water. They don't have just like stable pipes and things like that. So we partner with Connect Africa. Connect Africa is an organization. It's located in Uganda. They want to help us to train like people who just like maintain those water things and everything. So, and then the challenge now is just like to raise money. We need about like $6,000 to take like 3 people from the village to take them to Kampala, Uganda, and then be trained. And then the other 3,000 is just to buy like the new set of tanks and everything, and then train the villages. This is the biggest challenge now. So after we provide them with the water, the community with the water, we're going to take the lead and then build the school. That's one of the things we are doing now.
We're almost out of time for this segment, but I just want to quickly get a sense of what's going on in Kansas City to help support these grassroots efforts to support Sudan, and how are people kind of staying connected to keep this going? Maybe Martin?
One of the things we started at JVS is a meeting of local community organization leaders. We encourage them to attend the meeting so that they could tell us what the needs are in their community here and how we could use resources within the community to meet and address those needs. And one of the meetings we had the police, 4 majors from the Kansas City Police Department come and tell them on how to act when the police pull them over so they can provide this information back to their communities based on an incident that happened some time ago with a pregnant Sudanese woman that was accosted by the police, and eventually she was thrown in jail and she lost the baby. And another thing, the last meeting we had was a financial empowerment whereby we have some groups like Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, UMKC School of Business, and even KC Suslink come provide information about financial empowerment and how to avoid predatory lenders. And we are also moving forward with organizing events to sensitize the Kansas City public about the various other communities we have here. And we have our Crossroad of Culture event coming up on May in collaboration with 10,000 Villages. And then on June 23rd, we're going to be showing a film on Bhutanese called Killing the Time. And then on July 18th at the Screenland Theater, we are going to have a film on disability. So we not only bring the community leaders together, but we link them to resources within the Kansas City community to better help their members.
So a lot of educational resources available for everybody here. We're going to end with this final call here from Susan in Independence. Susan, you're on Central Standard.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just had the privilege of working with some of the Sudanese that were here in the northeast Kansas City a number of years ago, and I was just so impressed with the emphasis on education. They wanted their kids to get in school, and the emphasis, too, on wanting to learn to speak English and how little help we give in that area. It's very, very hard to find, especially for older people who want to learn, but it's just difficult. So I was impressed with the industry. At least one woman started a restaurant in Kansas City, and she also had a daycare center for a very short time. And so I was impressed with that industriousness, that they really wanted to learn and contribute to our presence in Kansas City.
Susan, thank you so much for calling in. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to say thank you all for joining us today. Martin Aperiki, the Community Outreach Advisor at Jewish Vocational Services. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
John Okwe, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Rebecca Mabior and Atem, keep up the good work. We appreciate you coming on the air today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. When we return, a local organization that's helping musicians get access to healthcare and to the big-time national music scene, South by Southwest. Stay with us. Central Standard returns in a moment.